Hi, I'm Dr. Robert Pearl, former CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, Kaiser Permanente, a Stanford Medical and Business School professor, a Forbes contributor and best-selling author of the book Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong.
And I am Jeremy Corr, host of the New Books in Medicine podcast. American healthcare is broken. Across the United States, there are over 200,000 patient deaths from medical error every year, growing physician burnout, outdated technology, and inconvenient and delayed care for patients. And on top of all of this, skyrocketing drug prices and increasingly unaffordable out-of-pocket patient expenses. For decades, our nation's political and medical leaders have talked about fixing the American healthcare system, and yet the problems are now greater than in the past.
Every other industry that is inefficient and ineffective has experienced disruption. Healthcare will be no different. The question is whether the solutions will come from inside the healthcare system or be imposed on it. We'd like to invite you to listen to our new podcast, Fixing Healthcare with Dr. Robert Pearl and Jeremy Corr. Each episode will feature one of the top leaders and innovative thinkers in healthcare today. The show's format is simple. The guests will present a roadmap for fixing American healthcare's biggest problems. And from there, Jeremy and I will scrutinize the plan and help listeners separate fixes that have the potential to succeed from simply the hype.
Our goal is that everyone from healthcare consumers to political and medical leaders will find value in the discussions on our show. You may not agree with the different solutions offered, but you will never again conclude that nothing can be done. We hope you will join us. Please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast software. For more information, visit our website at www.fixinghealthcarepodcast.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Medicine. I am your host, Jeremy Corr. Today, we will be talking to Dr. Samuel Harrington. He is here to talk about his excellent book, At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life. This book outlines specific active and passive steps that older or terminally ill patients and their families can take to ensure they live the last of their days comfortably and die the best death possible. Sam, welcome to the show.
Oh, Jeremy, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate this opportunity.
I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Certainly. I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Maybe that's starting too soon for you. And then I wanted to be a physician from about the time I was in high school on. And ultimately, after getting through medical school at the University of Wisconsin, I chose internal medicine and subsequently gastroenterology as specialties that I thought suited my interests. And in particular with gastroenterology, I was interested in the concept of scopes and minimally invasive surgery, which actually, and the scopes, of course, predated what has become minimally invasive surgery now, and has revolutionized the surgical field. And if I'd foreseen that, I might have ended up being a surgeon. But in any event, I really had no great aspirations other than to be the best possible gastroenterologist that I could. And I ultimately trained in Atlanta and got a job in Washington, D.C., where I practiced for 30 plus years. And while I was in Washington, I served on the board of a hospice, which really drew me into end-of-life discussions. But then I was also on the board of the local community hospital where I worked, which was ultimately taken under the wing of a larger organization, Johns Hopkins Medical Group. And I saw a small community hospital become part of a bigger system, and that also informed some of my ideas. So when my career seemed to have plateaued and I began to look around for other things and became interested in medical reform or healthcare reform, this book started to percolate in my head. And ultimately, I couldn't do it while I was practicing. I didn't have the mental or physical bandwidth. But when I stopped practicing, I started writing, and that's where we are.
The topic of your book is something that everyone either has experienced or will experience at some point, either with themselves or with a loved one. You know, the topic of facing end of life or end of life care and how to deal with that. And it's in your book, one of the things you talk about is how hard it is for not only the people that are in that situation, but their family members and their doctors to talk about, which I think this book is really excellent at outlining. So I wonder if you could, you know, share what your ultimate inspiration to write At Peace was.
Well, I was inspired to write about it by two sort of broad arcs that occurred across my 35 years of training and practice. And that is the arc of medicine, as I saw it in America, changing from a healing art into a giant commercial enterprise, which where end-of-life issues moved from comfort care and support towards sort of transactional treatments. We were able to do so much when I went into medicine. When I went into my practice in 1982, it was a much simpler time. And then this explosion of technology complicated our end-of-life perspective. And then if I superimpose on the arc of medicine, I superimpose on that the arc of my parents' aging and decline, there's a giant disconnect between what I was doing two patients in the hospital and what my parents wanted done for them at home. There was a giant disconnect between the way professional, aggressive physicians look at end of life and what we really should be, and what my parents wanted. And this book is an attempt to resolve that. So I was really inspired by the idea of empowering elderly patients and their families to make better end-of-life decisions, basically because I was witnessing too many elderly patients die in intensive care units, not because they didn't want treatment, but because they didn't really understand the likelihood of their coming out of the intensive care unit in a healthy way. They didn't understand that when they went into the intensive care unit, they either would not come out alive or they would come out quite diminished because of complications and prolonged hospitalization. And I felt that somebody needed to sort of stand up and help people understand that patients and families have a very high expectation of what's going to happen, and that doesn't always pan out for them.
Will you explain for our listeners why you feel, as you discuss in the book, that American healthcare is failing the elderly?
I believe that the American healthcare system is built to treat acute illnesses. It is built to treat aggressively. It is built to give good quality care within any given hospital, but that elderly patients are sort of a special category in the sense that doctors approach illness the way generals approach an enemy in the battlefield. They want to engage the enemy with overwhelming force. And doctors want to cure patients. And when there is something to be cured, we address it. But aggressive treatment rapidly or frequently moves into excessive treatment and ultimately futile treatment with elderly patients, because when a person is dying either with old age or dying of old age, that is a battle that cannot be won. And so American medicine has to learn how to approach that special circumstance differently. One of the things, this is segueing into a sort of a sophisticated I hope I don't get lost here, analysis of how systems don't always help us. Every hospital uses systems to improve their quality of care, which I applaud. The idea of checklists in operating rooms and having specialists step in under every circumstance and having specialized nurses and nurse managers and case managers work with patients through problems. This helps improve outcomes for any given process, whether the patient is being treated for an orthopedic joint replacement or a heart attack, or in my case, colitis, an inflamed colon or inflamed intestine. So we plug people into a system and the care is kind of automatically produced. People work through a process sort of like being on a conveyor belt. But when it comes to elderly patients, that blinds us to the fact that we're dealing with somebody who has a shorter horizon to approach. And I liken it to the way we engineer highways. We engineer highways to be safer at a given speed. Unfortunately, drivers don't say, well, this highway is engineered to be safe at 65, so I'm going to go 64 miles an hour. We say, this highway is safer than the last one I was on. I'll just pick up the speed. And doctors have that same sense when we plug a patient into our system. We say, oh, my last 85-year-old did very well with this. Maybe this 90-year-old patient will do well with this. And we sort of push the limits of things. And the idea of, so that's one way that systems don't work well for elderly patients, or how the American healthcare system isn't designed to help them. Another much broader perspective is that American healthcare has been hugely influenced by commercial practices. Commercialized practices. The U.S. Healthcare system has conflicting mandates or imperatives. We have to take care of patients, but we also have to make a profit to keep moving ahead. And so, with all the commercialization and advertising on television and media manipulation, we have a whole generation of people, largely baby boomers like myself, who are either becoming elderly or are in fact helping their parents with end-of-life decisions. So there's this giant over-expectation that everything is going to work out well. And if we can just cure this pneumonia, you're going to be fine. If we can just fix this colitis, you'll be fine. When in fact, every time we treat elderly patients, the acute process might be improved, but we also accelerate the aging of the chronic processes that are part of the aging process. So there's a lot to the concept that our healthcare system isn't built to help the chronically ill, weak elderly person. And my book is focused on elderly patients, not who may or may not be terminal. It's really not focused on younger patients who do in fact struggle with terminal illnesses.
So the media and culture in America encourages people to idealize beauty and youth and do everything they can, you know, as you said, with the commercialization, to feel younger than their years. While eating right, exercising, and having an overall good lifestyle is good, great for someone, it offers no guarantees. Can you talk about the impact of this false sense of immortality and the importance of having what you call a strategy to die better?
Yes. We in the United States consider health, we sort of equate health with a virtue. So by implication, we deny our mortality. And we are subject to promises by the government, promises by the media, promises by PR, public relations organizations helping market hospitals or treatments. And we tend to believe that. Americans are an optimistic people. We believe in American exceptionalism. We believe that the American healthcare system is the best in the world, when in fact it is not. It might be the best in terms of convenience and speed, but in terms of outcomes, it is definitely not the best. And we listen to politicians who talk about moonshots to cure cancer and news stories about how cures for dementia are right around the corner. And we tend to believe that those are true, when in fact they are largely the result of advertising hyperbole. And we also are inundated with advertising on television and the print media that semi-promise. They promise through implication excellent outcomes and for a variety of things, including lung cancer. And that's one of the things that's on television constantly, new treatments for lung cancer. Again, we are being manipulated into believing things that are not really as promising as they sound. Now, the United States is only one of two countries that allows direct-to-consumer advertising, and the other one is New Zealand, which is extremely small by comparison, of course, as a developed country. So no other giant developed country allows this. And what the end result is that we have really high pharmaceutical prices, and we have patients asking for specific treatments when in fact they may not be appropriate for that patient, but it is easier for a physician to move ahead with that kind of treatment than to counsel a patient against it. In my book, I tell a story of one of my patients who was 86 or 87 when she first came to me. She was extremely active woman who was very social, and she developed an inflamed colon late in life. It's called ulcerative colitis. And she did not respond well to typical treatments. The symptoms of ulcerative colitis are crampy abdominal pain and diarrhea, sometimes uncontrollable. And she found this extraordinarily inconvenient, which of course it is. It's a terrible illness. But sometimes it gets better spontaneously, just as it had occurred in her spontaneously. And newer treatments were just coming out at that time called, they were biologic treatments where they altered the immune system through an infusion of a biologic material that was basically an antibody that fought the inflammation process. And her family came to me, having seen this on television, and asked me to give her this infusion. And I had used it on other patients, but felt it hadn't been studied well in elderly patients. And I was quite hesitant. So I mentioned all this. I told them how hesitant I was. And I asked them to seek a consultation from a specialist in ulcerative colitis, and which they did. And the second opinion did not argue with them, plugged this patient into the system, meaning that it was easier to write an order to start the treatment than to have a very long discussion on the subject. And in 2 weeks, the patient was feeling much, much better. She was absolutely happy and thrilled with the outcome of her therapy. And 2 weeks after that, she had double pneumonia based on a germ that was released because her immune system was weakened by the biologic infusion she'd received. And 2 weeks after that, she died in the intensive care unit. And of course, I see a direct linear relationship to advertising and this woman's premature death. but not everybody will agree with me. In any event, that is the kind of process that I would prefer not to see. And in terms of strategies to avoid that, I think people have to think about where they will say no to medical care. Now, in terms of a strategy, her situation is perhaps not the best example in terms of saying no to the biologic treatment, although I would like people to think that. But her strategy might have been to say, I will try the biologic treatment, but I will set limits as to what should happen to me afterwards. For example, if I'm so sick that I have to go into the intensive care unit, do not do X, Y, or Z as a result of it. So that is the kind of strategic thinking that I'm trying to promote. Let me step back and maybe I can make that point a little bit clearer. 80 or 90% of elderly patients, when asked by medical professionals in medical surveys, express a preference to die at home as quietly as possible. And yet, 60% of elderly patients die in hospitals or nursing homes shortly after hospitalization. And that disconnect needs to be reconciled. And my point is that it's fundamental that if you want to die at home, a person has to know when it is appropriate to say no to hospitalization. And particularly in the elderly, hospitalization by itself takes a toll, and people who go in tend to come out weaker, even if they are successfully cured of the problem that took them in. So in a sense, saying no to hospitalization or saying no to intensive care unit treatment is the message of the book and the strategy that I hope people will employ.
In your book, one of the things you talk about is the importance of understanding the median survival of an illness. In fact, you compare it to the game Plinko from the show Price is Right. Can you please talk about this for our listeners and explain what you mean when you say they should avoid magical thinking and the median is the real message?
Well, thank you. There is a chapter called The Median is the Message, and that is a riff off of a very famous medical circles essay by Stephen Jay Gould, who wrote, "The Median is Not the Message," because of his experience with an illness called mesothelioma. In his situation, he was about 41 or 42 when he was diagnosed with a rare cancer, almost always fatal, that occurred in his abdomen, called a mesothelioma. And at that time, the median survival of mesothelioma was, I believe, 8 months. So he said, as a scientist, he looked and saw that some people survive much longer than 8 months. And that's called the long tail of a survival curve. And he writes eloquently about how he made the decision to work hard to be in that long tail. And in fact, he lived 17 more years and then died of lung cancer after a 2 or 3 year illness. Now, his eloquent essay moved many people, but I looked at it somewhat differently. I noted that he was diagnosed at a young age, and he did not, in fact, take the treatments that were used to define the survival curve of 8 months. He was lucky enough to take a different treatment that worked stupendously well for him. I appreciate that. That's wonderful. But that is not how survival curves are generally created. Survival curves are created by the multiplicity of decisions and procedures that occur to patients when they are being treated medically. And that's where my image of a Plinko board comes in, because every time a patient hits a decision, they either get better or get worse, or they treatment, they get better, they get worse, sort of like a Plinko disc fall into the bottom, from the top to the bottom of the Price is Right game. And ultimately, we cannot will where we end up on the bottom of the Plinko board. We can sort of game it and try and see and hope that we'll bounce way over into the long survival curve, but we can't will ourselves as to where we will end up there. And when it comes to elderly patients, I believe the median is the message, or certainly closer to the message. And that is because elderly patients start an illness from a disadvantage point of weakness, frailty, and chronic illness. So they are less likely to make it to the median than a younger person. So let me give a specific example that I believe is in the book. When my mother at age 82 was diagnosed with lung cancer, it was staged and determined to be stage 4, meaning quite advanced. And the median survival for stage 4 lung cancer at the time of her diagnosis was 10 months. Now, I looked at my 82-year-old mother, and I knew that she was frail. She had already survived breast cancer. She had multiple complications of osteoporosis. And in my mind, the likelihood that she would be one of the people to live to 10 months was not great. And I said to her, as I tried to explain the concept of median survival, you know, Mom, if there were 100 people in this apartment with stage 4 lung cancer, it would be very crowded, but in 10 months, 50 of them would not be here. We just don't know exactly which 50. Although the point I try to make in the chapter is that either the ones who are quite lucky or the ones who start from a younger, healthier vantage point are the ones who are more likely to make it to 10 months than my mother.
What are some of the most common illnesses for people over the age of 65 that lead to death? How do they lead to death, and why should we consider old age to be a diagnosis?
Well, medicine can be as complicated as we want to make it, or hopefully simpler if we try and change our perspective. So if we make it complicated, every single person has an individual outcome that we cannot try and characterize and understand. But in answer to your question, the CDC reports on diseases according to demographics, and the CDC clusters everybody over the age of 65 into a single demographic. And 90% of people over the age of 65 die from one of six diseases. And they are congestive heart failure, cancer, chronic lung disease, stroke, diabetes, and dementia in order of frequency. And the point I try and make in one of the chapters is that if you can put yourself in the category of chronic congestive heart failure or cancer or chronic lung disease or one of the others, then you can foresee some things that happen to people with those illnesses, and then you can see commonalities that occur at the end of life with one of these chronic illnesses. So, for example, people with congestive heart failure will die of a variety of things. There's no way I can give an exhaustive list of them, but they will either have heart attacks or arrhythmias, or more commonly die of fluid accumulation in the lungs that leads to pneumonia, or they will be bedbound and get bed sores and weakness from prolonged bed rest. And the complications of bed rest. Similarly, patients with chronic lung disease will have a tendency to get pneumonias and respiratory infections. They will they tend to be thinner than other patients because they have so many. It takes so much energy to breathe, and their appetites may be suppressed. But they too will become bedbound and will become subject to infections of the bedbound population. People with cancer die, unfortunately, of multiple complications related to cancer, but frequently infections and pneumonia will be involved. And my point is, if we can look for commonalities like pneumonia, things that can be illnesses that can be electively declined, where we electively decline treatment, but would otherwise offer a comfortable path to a comfortable death when palliated with other medications, these are parts of the strategy that one can address if you can recognize the illness that's likely to carry you away. And just as I was willing to talk to my mother about lung cancer, its potential complications and prognosis, I think every patient should be able to talk to their primary care doctor or their specialist about that particular disease that is the most important one complicating their life, and understand a little bit about how it might end, and what they can do to either control that end, to manipulate it rather than control the end, I should say, either to influence a quieter death or not. I'll tell a story that I think is central to my book about my father and how he envisioned things, at least briefly. My father was a very healthy man at the age of 88. He certainly appeared healthy. He was quite vigorous, completely independent, living alone, and he was helping other neighbors get to a community center for their water aerobics class, etc., because some of them had given up driving, but he had not. In any event, he had seen his doctors, and he had what was called an abdominal aortic aneurysm noted and monitored. Now, this aneurysm is a ballooned blood vessel that is a ballooned blood vessel that tends to grow. And when it grows, it threatens rupture. And when it ruptures, terrible complications arise. And my father was aware of this because he had had a legal client who had died of a ruptured aneurysm in his chest. Well, my father's aneurysm was in his abdomen, and at age 88, two internists and three surgeons had told him to have major surgery to permanently repair it. And I thought that such a big operation would threaten his independent existence by putting him in the hospital for 3 weeks at a minimum, and if a complication for much longer, some nursing home convalescence. And when he got home, he might not be as strong as he had been, and he might not be as independent as he wanted to be. So I was counseling him to take a temporary procedure called an endovascular repair, which is like a giant cardiac catheterization, to put strengthening coils in his aneurysm. And this seemed like a very logical thing to do from a medical perspective, because he would probably live 3 to 5 more years without complication, and then we would readdress the problem. And he would not be in the hospital for at all. Hopefully it could be done as an outpatient. And my father looked at me as if I was speaking a different language, because he, when I talked about this temporary procedure, he furrowed his brow and he pointed his finger at me and he pursed his lips and he said, "Sam, why would I want to fix something that's going to carry me away the way that I want to go, quickly and decisively?" And I was quite taken aback. But this was his vision. He had this concept that if he declined emergency surgery, he would take palliative pain medicine and be dead within hours or a day at the most. And obviously there's a naivete to that and a randomness to it. And yet it was his way of seeing an illness, seeing an end to that illness and then manipulating it. And it was to what he perceived his advantage to control it to the degree he could control it. And this was visualizing an end to an illness, which is, I believe, where we started this conversation. And if everybody were to look at their illness, and in this case, I'm trying to encourage people to fall into one of those six categories, and saw a something that they could do to decline aggressive treatment at some point to say no to medicalization, then they will be moving toward a more comfortable death. Now, most of us will not have an opportunity to decline emergency surgery the way my father had hoped to. But some of us will have that opportunity. Some of us with congestive heart failure will have an opportunity to say no to a pacemaker or other mechanical assistance for a weak heart. Some of us will be able to say no to or discontinue dialysis for kidney failure. Many of us will have an opportunity to say no to a third, fourth, or fifth course of chemotherapy for a cancer. And for those of us, if we're lucky enough to live to a very advanced age, 85, 90, 95, many of us will have an opportunity to say no to antibiotics for routine infections that plague the chronically ill and frail patients. So that is how, if we can see the illnesses that are influencing us and come up with, understand how they might come to an end, we can influence that end and avoid too much treatment.
You talk about the importance of recognizing this pattern of recurrent systems or symptoms, treatment, deterioration, and stabilization. If one recognizes this cycle of unproductive treatment and progressive decline, you suggest they consider refusing treatment and choosing comfort over a prolonged and painful dying process. In fact, there is even a chapter in which you have a few hypothetical death certificates from common causes of death and work your way backwards from them. Doing this provides insight into where in the dying process the best death might have occurred. Can you talk to us about the insight provided by this exercise and the importance of creating a vision of where one's best death might occur and sharing that vision of comfort with family, friends, and physicians?
I use the chapter on death certificates as kind of a shorthand way of presenting a variety of diseases so that people can see common endpoints and a way of looking at death retrospectively, because sometimes retrospective viewing of things is informative. And so using those death certificates, as you say, I sort of plot a course in each one and then tell people that this is where somebody might have chosen to take a different course and to go home and be more comfortable. One of the, and this is part of the creation of a vision of where people should, a vision of a person's death. But let me give a different example of how retrospective analysis helps us. Medical futility is very difficult to define, and most of us try not to define it. What is futile care? Where does care segue from good care to aggressive care to futile care? Where, for example, in the case of the woman with the ulcerative colitis who went to the second opinion with a specialist, got the infusion, got better, and then got worse from double pneumonia, where might she have said, or her family have said, care is this care has become futile? Was it when she went into the intensive care unit? Was it when they put in the breathing tube? Was it a week after the breathing tube that she hadn't gotten better? These are difficult to define, but I believe that futile care is easily seen in retrospect when we look at the last treatment that our loved one endured, and when we say to ourselves, I wish we had not done that to my mother, I wish we had not done that to my aunt or uncle. That defines futile treatment. And the point is that we want to try and foresee that and avoid it. And I think experienced doctors should be able to help us with that. And we need people to help us understand prognosis and help us understand, help us with our vision. Let me go back to the vision idea for a minute. I think the vision helps us to have end-of-life conversations about the use of breathing machines or dialysis or feeding tubes. And my father's vision of declining emergency surgery is a kind of extreme vision, but a vision comes in many forms. And if we can understand it, we can use that to get better answers about some of these aggressive treatments. So I will point to a quote I use in the book from Woody Allen, who said famously that he was not afraid to die. He just didn't want to be there when it happened. Well, that his vision is to die in his sleep, or that's my interpretation of it. And that can inform his family about how they should address things. If there's any treatment that would allow him to die in his sleep, that's sort of where they want to go with it. Using another comedian, Groucho Marx famously said, I want to live forever, or I plan to live forever, or die trying. Well, that's a vision of dying in the intensive care unit. And that opens up that discussion. Do you really mean that, Mr. Marx? Okay, well, now let's talk about what that means. And here's what can happen in the intensive care unit. This is a bit of a segue. I gave a lecture recently at Yale, and I learned that family members are allowed to round on patients, go with the doctors and nurses when they see family members in the intensive care unit. And this, of course, helps family members understand what is going on when patients are being treated there. This was in particular in the surgical intensive care unit. But a light bulb went on in my head saying, you know what, this is really going to inform the next generation of that family as to what happens in the intensive care unit. Because some people, not only will they see and understand what's happening to their loved one, but when those things don't work out well, they will understand, well, maybe that's not for me when my time comes to be there. And so I think this is a wonderful development in more forward-thinking intensive care units. I think that we as Americans don't like to acknowledge terminal illnesses. And yet it's critical to me, to my patients, or giving advice to my patients, that we acknowledge that this is the illness that's going to carry us away. So now let us cope with it one way or another. The only illness in America that we acknowledge as terminal is ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, commonly known as Lou Gehrig's disease. When somebody is diagnosed with ALS, everybody says to themselves, oh my, that's a terminal illness. And that's largely because it's a comparatively infrequent illness, and there's no advertising about advances in its treatment, in my opinion, whereas other illnesses like cancer or dementia are equally terminal at some point, but we are bombarded with promises of treatment, and we tend to believe that we're going to get better. So we tend not to say, "Oh, this is terminal." We tend to say, "Oh, I'll get through this. We'll beat this. We'll carry on." And of course, we should struggle as far as we can, but then we have to recognize when this particular illness has moved from a terminal diagnosis to a terminal condition, meaning less than a year to live or less than 6 months to live. And I think trying to be rational about it is a very important, and ignoring it is a way to end up getting treated more than we would want. Thinking, okay, I'll just have one more treatment, this will be fine, go into the hospital, have a complication, and then the momentum to treat carries us on into more treatments, ultimately into the intensive care unit, and ultimately into the death that we hadn't really prepared ourselves for.
Can you please provide and explain the punchline of the joke? Do you know why they nail coffins shut?
Okay. When I was a young gastroenterologist, I was asked to see a patient in consultation by a family physician who had asked me to see a man who had stomach cancer, and he had multiple obstructions in his stomach, and his oncologist had recommended a variety of tubes to vent the stomach while chemotherapy was given some time to work. And the oncologist had recommended this largely because the family had said that they thought their loved one, or their father, was too old to have major surgery. And I saw the patient and felt that it was very unlikely that chemotherapy was going to be beneficial in any rapid way, and that the obstructions in the stomach were, in fact, a surgical problem, and that my various tubes that I would put in as a gastroenterologist were not likely to make improve him symptomatically enough for the chemotherapy to work. So we had a very long discussion, and ultimately I recommended that he seek palliative care. And the family ultimately came to agree with that conclusion. And I left the room at some point and asked the family practitioner who had brought me in as a consultant what the oncologist was thinking when he made these remarkable recommendations. And the family practitioner looked at me and he said, "Sam, you know why they nail coffins shut?" And then I said, "No." And he said, "To keep the oncologist out." And that's a fairly harsh judgment of oncologists, but there was a time when oncologists were less sophisticated than they are now. My story dates back 30 plus years, and there is a tendency in oncology to treat very aggressively very late in the disease, and many of us look at that and say, if it's, and question that kind of perspective. But we, as doctors, have to question all our perspectives. I put in feeding tubes and other tubes and what are called stents, things to open up clogged passages into patients that, in retrospect, I came to believe were overly aggressive. And I stopped doing some of those things by the end of my career. And so I'm not trying to condemn all oncologists, but I think every physician who is a subspecialist or a specialist has to question what we're doing to a patient instead of what we're doing for them when we are asked to do some of the highly skilled things we do at the end of a long life.
This is something actually my family recently experienced, unfortunately, where a member of our family was terminally ill from cancer and was provided with a false sense of hope and encouraged to undergo aggressive treatment instead of entering into hospice care until very late in the process. It felt like there was no compassion or regard for her comfort. It was a very heartbreaking experience for my family, and it was an awful and painful experience for her. As a doctor, how and when would you have what Dr. Atul Gawande calls the hard conversation?
Well, the hard conversation frequently comes to a specialist like myself when we are asked to walk into a room, such as the case I described with a patient with the stomach obstruction, and there's no way to get out of it. So the hard conversation sort of comes to us, and I believe we have to deal with it rather than simply say, okay, I'll put in the tubes and I'll get you on the schedule, put in the tubes tomorrow, see you later. We really have to have that discussion. And I think you started the question with the concept of hope and false hope. And I think that is an enormously important concept because everyone is worried about eliminating hope when we have the hard conversation, when we talk about the difficult prognosis. A famous surgical writer, Sherwin Nuland, who wrote a book about called How We Die, that came out in about 1992, wrote that hope is, with reference to his own brother, who Dr. Nuland, the surgeon, advised to have chemotherapy when Dr. Nuland, knew that his brother had no real potential of survival. I was about to say hope of survival, but he would not deny his brother that hope. And he wrote that offering hope is done with the best of intentions, but the hell whose access road is paved with good intentions becomes too often the hell of suffering through which a misled person must pass before he succumbs to inevitable death. And my point is that hope, when there is hope to offer, let's do it. But false hope is a complication of futile care, and futile care is what I want to avoid for my elderly patients. And therefore, I think that people have to hope for something else when they receive a difficult diagnosis. Is it much more important the doctor counsel that they work on hope is something that they can leave behind with their family, hoping for a heritage that they can leave behind, some appreciation for themselves that they can leave behind. When I told my mother that she had a median life expectancy of 10 months, we didn't really hope to live that long, but we did hope to live 5 months long enough to get her to my daughter's wedding, her first grandchild's wedding. And the good news is we got her there, and that was something we could focus on that was more realistic than a long survival.
What is a good death? What are the emotional attributes of a good death and the physical attributes of a comfortable death?
Well, a good death has been described brilliantly in several works, and one by Karen Kell, K-E-H-L. She had 13 attributes of a good death, and I will try and cull that down to five. The five attributes of a good death that I believe are important are control, meaning the kind of control one can assert by saying no or to a treatment or by saying yes to something at home. So control, comfort, the absence of pain is the second most important. Closure, the idea of being able to reconcile with family and friends. Affirmation, meaning being valued by your friends and relatives, having your values appreciated. And trust, surrounding yourself in an environment that's familiar, with which you're comfortable, and with caregivers that you trust. So control, comfort, closure, affirmation, and trust. But if you flip each one of those attributes, control becomes helplessness, comfort becomes pain, closure becomes isolation, affirmation becomes denial, and trust becomes frustration. Well, that's what it, those five detributes, if that's the right word, are define death in a hospital or in an intensive care unit. Mm-hmm. So that really defines a good death. And to get to that point, you have to seek an alternative health system, an alternative to the test and treat that makes up aggressive medical care in the United States. And that alternative is palliative care and ultimately hospice care. And I believe that people should, when they recognize that a medical treatment is likely to reduce the quality of their life, even if it does prolong their life a little bit, they are at the point where they should be thinking about palliative care. And of course, when you start thinking palliative care, then we want to segue into hospice care. And again, it is an alternative system that protects us from being taken to the emergency room for every little thing and starting over a variety of tests and treatments and getting into that cycle and getting onto that conveyor belt. So, I try to create the thinking that will help people see that point where it is appropriate to say no to aggressive care. And that point is basically defined by some degree of advancing age. Anyone over the age of 65, 75, 85 should be thinking this way. Advancing illness, meaning if your disease moves from stage one to stage four, and declining performance status, if we cannot take care of ourselves, if we lose the ability to bathe ourselves safely or move ourselves from a chair to a bed or a bed to a chair, that activity of daily living, when we our performance status declines, our disease advances, and our age advances and our disease accelerates, those lines intersect, and that is where a person should say no to aggressive treatment, yes to palliative care, and then start seeking the protections of hospice care.
If someone is listening to this as either a patient or a caregiver who is currently facing this scenario, I want to say I highly recommend this book. In it, you recommend specific steps to help them take control of the scenario they're in. In addition to that, what other resources are out there?
Well, starting the conversation by checking on the Five Wishes website. That's a good way to get you talking about a vision of death and then get into the conversation. The Stanford Letter Project is a way of getting into the conversation. There are prognosis sites usually associated with the best cancer centers. So if you are at MD Anderson or Sloan Kettering and want to study your prognosis, you can check on their site, and that will give you insight into questions that you can ask your doctors. My own website, samharrington.com, will connect you with me. I can guide more specific questions or give better answers when I have more specific questions. That's all that pops to mind right now.
Well, Sam, I've taken up a lot of your time today, and I really appreciate it. My final question for you is, what are you working on now?
Well, I'm two things, or one is I'm trying to promote this book. It has not taken off rapidly, and I want to continue getting the word out because I think it's a reasonable way of looking at end of life for elderly patients, and it can help people do a better job of that. And I'm looking into a second book that discusses either medical complexity or medical futility, because I think these are underrepresented in the literature of medicine that people can understand. There's plenty of academic work on the subject, but it needs to be translated for lay people to better understand the reality in which we live.
That sounds very interesting. When it's finished, you'll have to let me know. I can't wait to read it, and I hope you come back on the show to talk about that book as well. I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it, and it was an absolute pleasure to talk to you today. Take care.
Thank you very much, Jeremy.